So last time we were here, this is what, 2 weeks ago, I think, we looked at the question, who do you think Jesus is? And I suggested that at the very least we can agree that that there was a human being called Jesus on earth, that he was claimed to have done remarkable things, that he was a teacher in line of the Jewish religion, who believed in the end of the world, who had a high place for love and compassion in his teaching, and also put himself and his person at the centre of his message, that his message was not only believe in God, but was also believe in himself, and that it was claimed that Jesus died and rose again. People claim Jesus came back from the dead. And so now we're kind of coming back to that question and asking, can anybody really believe that Jesus did miracles? Could you really today at university in the 21st century in the Western world really believe that Jesus literally, actually, historically performed miracles? Surely not. Well, that's the question we're looking at together today for about half an hour, and then there will be time and opportunity for you to ask me questions. An example, if you have access to a Bible, we do have some up the back if you'd like to read along. Otherwise, you can just listen. But in the Gospel of John, it lists a series of Jesus' miracles, the first of which is a famous one, the turning of water into wine. So in John chapter 2, Jesus is at a wedding, and they run out of wine at the wedding. And so Jesus' mother comes to Jesus and says they have no more wine in John chapter 2, verse 3. And then in verse 6, we're told that nearby there were six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, now draw something out of those jars and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from, though the servants had drawn it new. And then he called the bridegroom and said, hey, everyone gives out the choice wine first before people are drunk. The good wine first and then cheaper wine later after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best till now. And then John says, this is the first of Jesus' miraculous signs he performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory and his disciples put their faith in him. Water, huge jars filled with ordinary water turned into wine, good wine. In John chapter 5, we read the story of Jesus healing someone who was unable to walk. In John chapter 9, we read of Jesus, 6, we read of Jesus walking on the top of water and feeding people, massive thousands of people, with a small amount of food. In John chapter 9, we read of Jesus healing a man who was born blind. In John chapter 11, we read the raising of Lazarus, who had been dead for 3 days, raising him back to life. And then in John chapter 20, we read the story of Jesus having been dead and buried, coming back to life. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, John chapter 20, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb where Jesus was buried and saw the stone that had been rolled across the tomb, a cave with a massive stone in front. The stone had been rolled away. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said, they've taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they put him. So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running. And then we read they arrive at the tomb. In verse 6, Simon Peter, who was behind another disciple, arrived, went into the tomb. He saw strips of linen lying there as well as burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth folded up by itself, separated from the linen. Finally, the other disciple who'd reached the tomb first also went inside. He saw and believed. And then we meet Jesus, risen from the dead now. He meets Mary in the garden around the tomb. And Mary at first thinks he's a gardener and says in verse 15, sir, if you've carried away Jesus' body, tell me where you've put him and I will get him. But then Jesus said to her, Mary, and she turned towards him and looked at him and went, teacher, Rabboni. Jesus had risen from the dead. Mary says in verse 18, I've seen the Lord. And she told them about these things. A bit later on in verse 24, Thomas, called Didymus, one of the 12, who was not with the disciples when Jesus came, the other disciples told him, we've seen the Lord risen from the dead. But he said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side where a spear was put, I will not believe it. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Through the door, though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood there with them and said, "Peace be with you." And he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." Jesus told him, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who've not seen me yet believed." Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing have life in his name. But can you believe? Should you believe? Can anybody believe that this man in history was killed and came to life all over again? Can you really believe that somebody born blind could see? That someone dead 3 days could come back out of their grave? That a small amount of food could feed thousands of people? That someone who could not walk would be able to walk again? That large jars of water could be turned to... Really? Many philosophers have said, no, you can't believe this. This is ridiculous. Famously, David Hume argued that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony is of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact it's testifying to. So the only time you'd believe a miracle is if someone claimed about a miracle that it would be more miraculous if they were lying than the miracle happened. And so many people, maybe not thinking as deeply, might just say, miracles. Maybe that's you. You just go, miracles? Really? No, come on. Really? Not miracles, surely. Maybe God, maybe love your neighbour, but miracles? Well, that's what we're looking at today. I want to unpack this objection into three parts, because I think there are three versions of the objection to miracles. Three versions, slightly different. The first is the someone who wants to say the idea of a miracle, the concept of a miracle is ridiculous. So it just makes no sense. So it doesn't make sense is the first objection. A second objection is maybe miracles are possible, but you are never justified to reasonably believe them. You see how those two are different? One person says there cannot be miracles, there just can't be. A second says maybe there can be, but there is no good reason ever to sensibly believe they happen. And then a third reason is it's dangerous to believe in miracles because it stops rational thinking. Once you start believing in miracles, before you know it, you'll believe anything. You see how those are three slightly different objections? And when people say, "Oh, I don't believe in miracles, it's irrational," they could mean any one of those things. It's nonsense, it's unjustified, it's dangerous. So let's take each of those in turn. First, can you say, can you prove to me that belief in miracles is a nonsense, that it is fundamentally, first principles, irrational? Yeah, there's no place for the idea of miracles. This comes from an assumed philosophy, not so much a science as a philosophy of naturalistic, a mechanistic, naturalistic view of the universe. So that is a philosophy view, not a scientific view, a philosophy view, that this universe of natural cause and effect is closed and everything within it can be explained by natural explanations, evidences, theories, causes and effects. So, for example, a kind of Christian writer, Rudolf Bultmann, said this: "The historical method includes the presupposition that history is a unity in the sense of a closed continuum of effects in which individual events are connected by the succession of cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. This continuum, furthermore, cannot be broken by the interference of supernatural transcendental powers." Closed system. So you cannot have a miracle if you believe that, because a miracle interrupts a natural closed system, a mechanistic, meaning everything every bit, it's like a machine, like a clock. Every cog turns the next cog. There's always a cause. Or philosopher John Macquarie, the way of understanding miracles that appeals to a break in the natural order and to supernatural interventions belongs to a mythological outlook and cannot commend itself in a post-mythological climate of thought. The traditional concept of miracles is irreconcilable with modern understanding of science and history. Science proceeds on the assumption that whatever events occur in the world can be accounted for in terms of other events that also belong within the world. And if, on some occasion, we're unable to give a complete account of some happening, the scientific conviction is that further research will bring to light further factors in the situation, but factors that will turn out to be as this-worldly as those already known. Within that kind of way of thinking, you could say there is place for marvels, as in like amazing things, massive coincidences, astonishing medical, you know, you hear stories about someone being stabbed through the head by some kind of metal pole and surviving and changing their personality and becoming a genius. That's a marvel. It's not a miracle. It's very rare and very amazing, but it's not technically miraculous. Now, does that argument, does that prove it then? You can't believe in miracles. It's irrational. I want to say to you, that is a coherent, philosophical kind of religious belief. It's coherent, it's rational, but it is not necessarily the most rational and the most coherent. It's an assertion. It's a claim, a truth claim, a philosophical kind of religious truth claim about the way the universe is. And you can't prove it with science. It's not itself a scientific claim. It's a philosophical claim, right? What if there is a God? Yeah, what if there actually is a God who created the universe and is the ground of all being? What if all of the causes and the effects, the water cycle and the forces of gravity and electromagnetism, what if all that is in the regular course of things is actually structures and systems and patterns that God sustains and maintains? If that is true, and that's possible conceptually, it's possible rationally to believe there could be a God who holds everything together, it is then possible, if that is true, for that God to occasionally stop the ordinary pattern of things and to do something extraordinary. It's possible, although most of the time nature runs this way, for that ordinary working to be interrupted either by a marvel or by a supernatural cause. God interrupting the ordinary course of things. You see this kind of way of looking at things in Hebrews chapter 1. You can come across there if you can get there quick enough. Otherwise, I can just read to you. Here is a religious view of the universe, a Christian view of the universe. It's not a picture of a closed clock that cannot be entered into by God, closed system. Instead, we read about Jesus, the Son of God, Hebrews 1 verse 3, the Son, God the Son, S-O-N, God the Son is the radiance of God's glory, the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. It's a common teaching in the Bible that it's not simply, the Bible way of thinking about God is not simply God caused the world and then the world just runs without God like this. Or God caused the world, it runs without him, and every now and then he presses pause and walks into it and changes things around like a theatre sports game and then presses play again. But that actually God is, even in the regular course of natural life, sustaining all things. I want to put to you, that is a rational, coherent way of looking at the world. You cannot argue, I don't think, that miracles are fundamentally irrational. So let's move on to the second objection. Are you ever justified to believe in miracles? famous skeptic philosopher David Hume wrote, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature and as firm and unalterable experience has established the laws of nature, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as evident as any argument can possibly be imagined. In other words, he's not saying miracles are logically impossible. He's just saying for a miracle to be a miracle, it has to be miraculous. It has to be the opposite of the way things ordinarily happen. And if it's the opposite of the, if 99.9999999999999% of people who die stay dead, if most people stay dead, so we can say it's a law of nature, dead people stay dead, then if one person rises from dead, miracle. But then we've got so much evidence that dead people don't rise, as what possible evidence could we have to believe this when all of that? Did you see what he's saying? There's so much evidence here, how could you ever take that seriously? Did you know that in the American White House, all of the current leaders of America are actually lizard aliens? What would it take for you to believe this? To believe that lizard aliens are ruling the American White House? How much evidence would you need to even begin to seriously consider this claim? You would need a lot of evidence to even stop and pause and even consider it for a moment, wouldn't you? That's the argument. And so you would say, maybe, like that John Macquarie said, maybe there will be a future scientific explanation we don't know yet, suspend judgment. Maybe people are lying or mad, or there was an illusion that tricked people to think any explanation, however improbable, is more probable than belief in the miraculous. This is a slightly different argument, yeah? So it's saying, it's not so much saying it's illogical or fundamentally irrational as saying there's no good reason for any thinking person to believe them in practice, right? However, believing and considering and investigating the extremely unlikely is an important thing even within history and within science, isn't it? Like, those of us here maybe who are studying physics can tell us all about the ridiculously absurd and impossible things that we've come to a point of accepting are a part of the way the very, very small and the very, very big things in the world behave. It's hard to imagine. And yet by entertaining the incredible, we learn new things. So even within science and history and things, we learn this. And so there needs to be a place to be open to the unexpected. More than that, we need to realise that the kind of miracle we meet in the Bible is not a miracle without context. So if Shay just suddenly ran into the room and said, "You'll never guess what I just saw, guys. A bus was floating in the air and it turned into a pumpkin and then it exploded and it rained down money and I got millions of dollars, except it's gone now because it turned into water. And that's why my hands are just a little bit wet. Can you see? Just see it." Now, without any other context around that, you just go, "Shay's not well." We need to talk about Shay. However, if in the context of established religious community, tradition, expectations, writings, in a context, if what William Lane Craig calls a religio-historical context, if that becomes one where there are other reasons to help us interpret claims and expect claims of a particular kind, then the number of times when you will stop and take a claim seriously shrinks. It's no longer every possible claim of something weird. It's no longer every time something bizarre happens you go, "Must have been a miracle." It's no longer turning off your brain and just saying God did it, but it's instead going, in certain contexts when a string of factors are in place, I might, yes, begin to seriously listen to the evidences, the testimonies, the claims, the arguments that point towards certain things. Yeah? It's one of the reasons why there are such vast numbers of people who have come to faith in Christianity, even on modern 20th and 21st century university campuses. Because they have weighed and considered, despite good reason to be skeptical of lizards in the White House and exploding flying buses, despite being generally skeptical, given enough factors, enough reasons, enough testifying, they start to pause and consider, maybe here, I do need to consider something more. But one more thing needs to be said on this point before I move on. And that is, the Bible does not present miracles as the final, absolute proof why you must believe in God and must become a Christian. The Bible doesn't say, become a Christian because this miracle happened, so-and-so said so. This miracle happened, such-and-such proves it. Therefore, 1 + 1 = 2, you've got to become a Christian, God exists. When you read the Bible, you see that actually it's written largely to people who already believe in the supernatural, who already believe in a God. It's already speaking into a way of looking at the world that assumes the existence of God. So that goes back to my first point. If you already are open to the fact that God might exist, because why is there something rather than nothing? What gives meaning and value to the universe and other reasons like this? Then you might already say, I'm open to the fact that there is a God. And so that then makes me more open to the possibility there could be miracles. And then my question becomes, where has God spoken? What is God saying? Who is God authorizing to bring his message to the world? And that's why it's very interesting in John's Gospel that again and again, these miracles of Jesus are not called wonders, marvels, powerful feats, but they're called signs, often, signs. And so in that first miracle, water into wine, we read, this was the first of his miraculous signs. He thus showed his glory and his disciples put faith in him. That is, the miraculous, remarkable things Jesus did were actually things that show something about who Jesus is. They interpret, they explain, they authenticate, they describe Jesus' identity and Jesus' saving work for the world. In fact, as we read through John's Gospel, we find many times when Jesus expresses skepticism about believing because of miracles. So Jesus actually doubts people who believe in Jesus because of miracles alone. So at the end of this same chapter, we read about how many people saw Jesus' miraculous signs and believed in his name, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them. He knew all men. He didn't need man's testimony about man. He knew what was in a man. He's doubtful of a person who purely and entirely builds their convictions around spectacular signs. If I already believe in God for other reasons, if I have multiple reasons to drive me towards considering Christianity, Jesus, the Gospels, and if there is overwhelming evidential testimonial weight, and these events are happening in this religio-historical context, then yeah, I think you are justified to genuinely consider that Jesus turned water into wine, healed a crippled man, fed thousands, gave sight to one who was born blind, called Lazarus back from his grave, and himself returned from the dead after his crucifixion. But lastly, is it ever wise to believe in miracles? Is it a good course of action? Yeah? This is the warning of people who say science replaced mythology and religion. Mythology and religion were pre-scientific explanations. I have no explanation for fire in the sky. It must be the thunder and lightning God. I have no explanation for what brings changes in the weather at unexpected times. It must be weather gods. I can't cope with what all these stars are out here. They must themselves be dead gods or heavenly realities and spirits and so on. But now we know, don't we? Now we know. There's reasons for things. God did it is not the reason. There's other reasons. There's cause and effect reasons for things. Yeah? Now we know. And so we must not ever say God did it, the spirits did it, because that's lazy, that's unscientific, that's a dead end, it's hitting a wall. God did it. Oh, I wonder what makes water turn into ice. Oh, it doesn't matter, God did it. You know what I mean? And so you can just, every time, and how do we fix that problem? Ah, don't fix it, just pray. Just pray about it. Is there a danger there? Well, I want to comment to you that actually understanding cause and effect is not entirely a modern thing. In fact, the Bible text itself says God gives the rain and also describes how the waters run into the sea and then the waters return to where they came from and describes patterns, natural causes and effects. Even some of the miracles in the Bible might be better called astonishingly coincidental marvels, since that we get at least some partial natural explanation involved in them. Diseases brought by plagues of animals, waters driven back by winds coming over in the evening, and so forth. You see, there's a difference to an overall lazy, irrational, superstitious belief and the occasional, considered openness to supernatural explanation. And to say that you must never have a supernatural explanation or you'll become an irrational, mythological person just does not follow. It's the same kind of simplicity of belief that has no place for taxes and considers them all to be theft by tyrants. Well, yes, tyrants can steal from the population, but that doesn't mean all tax is theft. Surely there's a middle area there, isn't there? And so you could say that belief in refusing to be open to the supernatural for this reason is kind of like the same kind of thing. It's an overly simplistic thing. And again, I point to the fact that throughout history, great pioneers in science, in reason, in history, faculty on our own university campus, campuses around Australia and the world, hold deep religious beliefs, including beliefs in the miraculous, and yet are pushing forward their fields in scientific endeavour. So the claim that it's unwise to believe in miracles just doesn't hold. That's about all I've got time for in order to leave some space for questions, but let me just, by way of summary, put to you that it's not incoherent to believe in miracles. It could be coherent, irrational. It's not unjustified to believe in miracles. I think in the case of Christianity, it's justified. It's not unwise to be open to the supernatural. I think it can be held in a wise way. But all those signs in the case of Jesus point to something. And they say to you and I, hey, you know what? Even if you saw these miracles, even if you saw it all, would you believe? Would you be satisfied? And even if you did believe, would you actually in your heart surrender your pride and your self-control to instead let God be God? Ask God for forgiveness and turn back to him. Would you follow the sign that points to the forgiveness offered in Jesus and a welcome back into peace with your Creator? I'll pray very briefly and then Hannah will come up and help us field some questions. Dear God, we pray for one another that we may investigate thoughtfully and learn truly about you, about ourselves, about the world. And we pray that you will give us what we need to do to understand Jesus and what he means for us. Amen.
So if you do need to go, that's fine. You can head off to your class or whatever. I encourage you to read or fill in the little slip. That will just help us know who you are, figure out what's going to be helpful for you. And also, if you want to read the Gospel of John, we've got a couple of copies up the back. So if you want to read it or you want to read it with a friend, feel free to just pick one of those up or ask us if you can't find them. Questions? Do you have any at this point?
So we hear a lot about miracles that happened in Old Testament times and early New Testament in the Bible. Do you think that it's possible that similar sort of miracles like miraculous healing or raising the dead are possible to happen today?
Yeah, I do, but I'm sceptical about them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's the right stance. If God could have, God still can, but to be a devout Christian does not mean I must quickly believe any Christian claim of the miraculous. I have good reason to think even Christians can be mistaken or exaggerated in their claims about the miraculous. And there are some who abuse Christianity to make money and have techniques to make people think miracles have happened, to get money from foolish people, which is terrible, but it happens. All at the same time.
We'll go, Dave.
Have you ever come across a miracle?
No.
That was quick. Alan.
You talked about miracles being a breaking into the inside from the outside, but then we talk about Jesus and his miracles, and Jesus was on the inside. How does that work?
Inside and outside is funny, but yes, in the story of John's Gospel, actually, it begins by speaking about God who made the world by speaking the world to be. He spoke by his word to create the world, and then John says the word of God became flesh and dwelled among us. And so that's the claim of Jesus, that when we see Jesus in the world doing extraordinary things, We're seeing God who's become human. So actually, Jesus himself is a miracle of God becoming a human being. Yeah.
So if miracles are meant to point us to Jesus and God's forgiveness in Jesus, if we're curious about Christianity and Jesus and this forgiveness, should we be asking God for miracles?
Do we need more miracles to testify to things? You could ask God to perform more miracles. There's nothing wrong about... I pray... Have I seen a miracle? No. Do I often pray for God to show extraordinary, miraculous mercy on those who are sick or suffering and facing other difficulties? Regularly. You know? I don't necessarily expect he will, and I'm not shocked and disappointed when he doesn't, but I still insist on asking. So you could ask that, but the Bible's advice to you is not what you need is more miracles today. That's not the Bible's advice to you. The Bible's advice to you is look to this great miracle, Jesus himself, not just water into wine, but his death and his resurrection, which is the great work of God for our forgiveness and for our salvation. So there's one bit where Jesus says, oh, you ask for all these signs. You keep asking for signs. Well, it's actually people who don't want God who keep asking for signs. It's like religious tourism. More miracles, more miracles. He says, that's a sinful, selfish world that asks for signs. I'm going to give you one sign, and that's the sign of my death and resurrection, what he calls the sign of Jonah. And so that's the sign of God for us. That's the miracle of God for us. But by all means, pray, and I'd love to hear the story if you experience a miracle.
I've got a scriptural question, more to do with the Gospel of John itself.
Yeah.
But it's taken that John is written as the last Gospel, and presumed that he had access to the other three Gospels as sources to help write. Do you think that the emphasis that John places on miracles themselves could be attributed to him seeing the local church that he's in and wanting to feed into more the miracle bias and well, not miracle bias, but the miracles that the faith claims, and through that injecting more than was actually there to make it stronger as a claim?
Maybe. Yeah, it's always hard to guess and to read between the lines to know what was going on. There's lots of differences between this story of Jesus' life and teaching and the other Bible stories, Matthew, Mark, Luke. And one of them is there's less miracles and more teaching in the Gospel of John, and an emphasis on the true response to Jesus is more than simply marvelling at miracles. So maybe a thing that he was especially interested in doing was saying, don't just love all those amazing stories about Jesus doing cool things. Yep, that's a thought.
So, Maggie, I'm just going to travel with this so you can understand it properly, but I did have, like, a miracle. I don't know if it was a miracle or not, but, like, in Matthew 21:22, it says, like, if you believe, then you shall receive. With that, when I was in medical school on March the 5th, and, like, I had to do an EEG and an MRI scan, so I just prayed to God before I went into my my test, and I just said, God, can you prove to me that there's nothing going on in my test? I got the test back at like 7 o'clock at night after waiting 5 hours, and they came back clear. So I just prayed about that. Like, is that sort of like a miracle that might happen, or don't know?
Maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. We'll wrap up before there.